KZSU-FM Stanford. Welcome to another edition of Hearsay Culture. My name is Dave Levine. I'm an assistant professor of law at Elon University School of Law in Greensboro, North Carolina, as well as a fellow at the Center for Internet Society at Stanford Law School. Thank you for joining me today on Hearsay Culture. Today, I'm excited to have on Laura DeNardis, who is the executive director of the Yale Information Society Project and who authored a book last year called Protocol Politics, The Globalization of Internet Governance. This is a very interesting topic and one that we're going to explore in depth over the next hour. How the Internet runs is one of those great mysteries to a lot of people. And, of course, there's various technological mysteries as to how web addresses work and what have you. But there's also broader mysteries about exactly who is responsible for making sure that the Internet is stable, who makes sure that the Internet is operational. In fact, more broadly, who sets the rules for the Internet? And this has been an issue that scholars and practitioners and policymakers have been dealing with since the dawn of the modern commercial Internet, about 15 years or so years ago, give or take. And today we're going to be focusing particularly on protocols, which are, and I'll allow Laura to define them in more detail, but protocols basically are the rules by which the Internet operates in terms of having an address pop up or used or operate in a web browser and a user's ability to access that web page. And I've dumbed it down severely, but we'll get into a higher degree of detail with our guest. The interesting subtitle here is The Globalization of Internet Governance. And the political angle of governance is one that we'll be exploring in more detail here as well. Because, of course, the rules set the stage for what countries, what commercial entities, and what individual citizens can do and cannot do on the Internet. So how these rules are shaped, the procedures under which they are shaped, and what those rules ultimately say are very important, not only for consumers, but for any business or government that wants to exploit the Internet for good or not good. So there's a lot of political gamesmanship and diplomacy and negotiation that goes on in the very operation of the Internet. And in Laura's book, Laura takes a very detailed look at these issues, both from a technical side as well partially from a technical side, I probably should say, and more from a political and social side to figure out how the Internet operates. This is a topic that we've discussed with several guests. Paul Ohm, for example, was on discussing these issues with respect to hackers and with respect to entities that can monitor Internet traffic. And more recently, we had Professor Jackie Lipton from Case Western Reserve University School of Law, my alma mater, who has written about IP addresses in particular and trademark and domain name issues. So we continue that discussion today with Laura. And as I mentioned, Laura is the executive director of the Yale Information Society Project. She's also a lecturer at Yale Law School and is the co-author of Information Technology in Theory. So without further ado, Laura is joining us by Skype from her home in Connecticut. Laura, thank you for joining us today on Hearsay Culture.
Thanks very much, Dave. It's great to be here.
So, Laura, let's start off with a general background question. I guess I should also point out that we are recording this show on July 6th. Laura, I asked this general question of all of my guests. I'll ask it of you as well. First, your background in more detail. Why did you become interested in these issues?
Sure. Well, I consider myself to be a scholar of Internet governance and regulation, which is a really interesting area. As you mentioned, I teach at Yale Law School, and I'm the executive director of the Information Society Project, which is really a wonderful intellectual community from which to study these issues. I actually have an engineering background. I have 2 degrees in engineering, and I have professional experience as an Internet designer and Internet strategist. So I kind of come from this from a technical background as a starting point. My first position out of graduate school was as an information technology strategist. I was first with Ernst & Young. It was actually called Ernst & Winnie back then, and I spent a number of years there and also at Meta Group, which is now actually called Gartner Group. And from that, I became very involved in early Fortune 500 company strategies on how to deal with the internet, and in particular, internet security. And I founded a company called Atlantic Consulting Group, and basically spent some time doing internet strategy during those early years of corporate internet use. So a big part of this was internet protocol selection. So that's how I became interested in the issues of protocols. I eventually pursued a PhD in a field called Science and Technology Studies, which has provided great tools for me to not just be a technical person, but to understand the social implications and political implications of internet protocol design and adoption and other internet governance topics. So by way of background, though, about why I wrote this particular book, I really think about this with four rationales. One is that I wanted to bring what I consider to be a very hidden world of internet standard setting to a more general audience and to convince people why I think we should be engaged in debates about protocols. The second reason is that I focused on a new internet protocol called IPv6. It's the primary case study that goes throughout the book. And I use this case study because it's actually at the heart of some very real debates that are happening right now, and a very real global dilemma, which we can get in a little bit later on, about how the internet is approaching, it's basically running out of internet addresses. So I thought it was an important case study. The third reason was, as an internet governance scholar, to try to present a framework for internet governance that goes beyond the usual issues of ICANN and domain names and to more technical and, I think, more powerful areas like the protocols, like intellectual property issues, underlying standards, and communication rights. So I kind of present a broad framework of internet governance. And finally, I use the book as a venue to present a framework for what I consider to be open standards. So a framework for openness and technical standardization as part of my work as an open standards advocate.
The Information Society Project is one that might be familiar to some listeners, but by way of background, can you describe that as well?
Sure. The Yale Information Society Project, we just call it the Yale IFP for short. It's a think tank at Yale Law School that was founded back in 1997 by Jack Balkin, who's still the Knight Professor of Constitutional Law and the First Amendment at Yale Law School. And he founded it to study the implications of the internet and new information technologies for law and society, guided by certain values of democracy, of innovation, and social justice. So it's a wonderful think tank. There are, at any given time, approximately 15 to 20 postdoctoral fellows. It's an interdisciplinary center, even though it's housed at Yale Law School. So we have postdoc fellows studying everything from law and media to privacy issues to access to knowledge, intellectual property, and as well as a host of Yale Law students who are student fellows, usually 15 or 20 student fellows at any time. So it's a vibrant, wonderful community. We have a network of alumni around the world and intellectual centers in other countries, particularly in the developing world, that are our research partners. And it's a really fun place. I feel very lucky to be part of it.
And as we were chatting off air prior to the show, Yale ISP has turned out some really terrific IP and technology law professors, and James Grimmelman, who's a friend, has been on the show previously, and you mentioned Beth Novak and others. So definitely a good contribution, a big contribution to the IP and technology world coming from Yale. Let's start with some very basic questions as we turn our attention towards your book. And I think the first overarching question, and this will be known to people that are familiar with internet operations, but for those listening who are not familiar with the technical side of the internet, what are protocols?
What are protocols? Well, I'll give you the mundane answer, and then I'll give you the more interesting answer. From a technical standpoint, they're blueprints. They're agreed upon blueprints that enable interoperability among technologies made by different manufacturers. So as long as a manufacturer adheres to certain standards or protocols, they will be able to produce technology that they can be assured will interoperate with other manufacturers' technologies based on those same standards. So that's a very dry definition, but these decisions that are made in protocols actually structure how we access information. They have great influence over innovation, the pace of innovation, and in which corporations will gain market dominance. And more importantly, they make direct decisions about our internet freedoms. But just to give a little bit of the technical background, because these can be very difficult to grasp, why is that? Because this is a very intangible area of internet policy, and sometimes very invisible to internet users, because protocols are not actually software code, and they're not material products like hardware. They're actually more like a language, textual and numeric language. And you know, as I said, they're the blueprints that enable technical interoperability. Probably the best way to describe that is by way of an analogy to real-world protocols. We have a lot of cultural protocols that we use on a day-to-day basis to communicate with each other, to greet each other, and do basically exist in the world. These are not necessarily enshrined in law, but they nevertheless regulate our human behavior. So an example of that would be how we greet each other. I do a lot of traveling. In some places, I greet a person by shaking hands. I was just in Brussels, and I greeted colleagues by kissing them on one side of the cheek, then the other. In other cultures, you bow. So these are protocols for how we greet each other. They're culturally constructed. They're not the same in every culture. It's the same way with technical protocols. Think about how traffic moves, not only on the internet, but in real life. When I'm driving somewhere, I see a red light, and I know to stop. I see a green light, I know to go. I see a yellow light, and what do we do, Dave? We speed up when we see the yellow light. These are the protocols. And, think about that by way of an analogy to technologies. Instead of providing order to real-world transactions and transportation and language and human interaction, what the technical protocols do is they provide order to the binary streams, meaning the zeros and ones that represent all information and the zeros and ones that all digital devices use to enable the interoperability that I'm speaking of. These are common data formats, common interfaces, networking conventions, and compression, any procedure that can enable the flow of information and interoperability among various devices. So before anyone's eyes glaze over, there are actually, I'm sure most of your listeners are familiar with very well-known protocols, and I actually use the term protocol synonymously with the term technical standard. So, Dave, probably people maybe right now they're using Wi-Fi. That is a set of standards. They use Bluetooth wireless. They use the MP3 format for encoding and compressing audio files. What are some other really common protocols? HTTP, which enables the standard exchange of information between web browsers and web servers. We are using certain audio technologies right now to communicate. There are a lot of standards that are being used just for this conversation to take place. So along with that, VoIP, Voice Over the Internet Protocol, is another really critical area of standardization that actually includes many different protocols. And there's JPEG, there are the various TCP/IP standards. So there are hundreds and hundreds, possibly even thousands of standards that are necessary for us to communicate over the internet. Dave, one of the reasons that this area is so interesting to me, it's not just the technical side, but the fact, and I'm quoting the historian of technology, Janet Abate, who wrote in the book Inventing the Internet, that protocols are politics by other means, and I really subscribe to that belief. They're points of control over global information architectures, and they, in many ways, serve as a form of public policy, but a public policy that's established by private institutions and technology companies rather than by legislatures.
The background here is fascinating, and I'll ask you this general question. But these protocols themselves, and your subtitle suggested, which is where we're headed, are not immutable. They can change, and of course, choices can be made as to what protocols look like and what protocols will be followed and what protocols will be ignored. You talk about, and we'll get into more detail, governance. But perhaps you could give the overarching description of internet governance? And really what I'm asking you is, who's in charge?
Right, that's a great question. Now, one of the most interesting aspects of this is that internet governance is really not done by governments. It's done by institutions primarily. So even using the term internet governance, which I do on a regular basis, is a little bit of an oxymoron. So I kind of subscribe to a broad view of internet governance. One aspect of that is the management of critical internet resources. So this would include the management of internet addresses that are required for communicating over the internet. It involves the management of domain names. This is what we normally think about when we think about internet governance. But other areas include intellectual property rights. So, in fact, intellectual property issues underlie many internet governance functions. This would include standards-based patents, technical enforcement of copyright protections, and then the usual things that we hear about related to domain name trademark disputes. It's also important to note that a host of communication rights issues underlie internet governance functions. I talk about one very important aspect of this related to privacy in my book, but not only privacy, but surveillance, censorship, freedom of expression. The decisions that are made by internet governance organizations really determine a lot of these things on a global basis, not on a national basis. On a national basis, there are lots of governance issues too, like control over conduits, and things like the net neutrality and broadband policy debates that are being worked out right now in the United States and elsewhere. Another area of internet governance is internet security. This is a huge issue, and it includes not only network security, but critical infrastructure protection. It includes authentication, authorization, encryption, and questions about public versus private control there. So these are all areas of internet governance. What I'd like to do is give a couple of examples of how some internet governance decisions are directly intertwined with governance decisions that we think of as classical governance decisions.
Okay.
So one example, I'll just stick with the area of internet protocols for now, since that's the subject of this particular book. So one example is the ways in would include the ways in which design decisions and standards make decisions about our civil liberties online, such as the extent of our privacy online. We certainly see this in the area of encryption protocols. This is perhaps the most obvious example of this. This is a very politically charged area because they often are an area that right at the center of conflicting values, the values of individual civil liberties versus government functions like law enforcement and national security. So in my book, I describe one particular decision within one particular protocol, IPv6, which I know we'll talk about later, where the designers, most of whom worked for private corporations, primarily United States corporations, had to make a decision, a very real decision, about the type of privacy that we would have while accessing the internet. So civil liberties, big area of governance when it comes to protocols. Now, something that intersects more directly with governance is when there are problems with standards. So if there are problems or vulnerabilities in protocols, this can directly interfere with the ability of governments to perform functions that are paradigmatic functions of government. So they can cause public safety concerns, loss of faith in political authority. You might, just to think of one example of this, probably the most well-known examples have to do with aftermath of various natural disasters. So you may recall that there was web browser incompatibility in the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina that prevented some victims from registering for aid on a FEMA website. We also saw a case where, in the aftermath of the Asian tsunami, there were problems with incompatible document formats among the various rescue agencies who were at that point just trying to identify the dead. So these kinds of things can create a loss of faith in governments. In the United States now, interoperability standards are really at the heart of some of the open government initiatives taking place in the Obama administration. And on a much more global level, there is a phenomenon right now where governments are developing government interoperability frameworks that get very specific with the kinds of protocols that they will select in order to perform e-governance services and other things. And there's even a more direct link between standard and political processes around the world and certainly in the United States. And this is when standards for digital media directly enter processes such as formal systems of political representation, authorization. The most obvious example of this is electronic voting. So there are certain tabulation standards underlying electronic voting. This is not an internet example, but just a general example of how the standards decisions can directly intersect with governance, and many more examples there. I just want to mention one other example of how protocols are public policy by other means.
Okay.
And this is in the area of innovation and competition policy. So the very idea, I talk a lot in my book about the politics of standards and the technical decisions behind that, but it's also a very important economic issue. The very idea of a standard is to create a level playing field on which innovation can proceed, and upon which things like the risk of experimentation can be lowered, because a company can take a standard and run with it and know that if they invest in a product based on the standard, they will be able to compete in markets. So this is an important area, and perhaps later we'll have a chance to discuss the issue of open standards, but the openness here is very important, and that just in a nutshell, that has to do with whether there are a lot of intellectual property restrictions on the standard, whether the standard is published so that people can use it. So whether there is this openness that determines what kind of innovation and competition can exist in the marketplace, and as well as how much global trade can take place. Why do I make that connection between standards and global trade? Because if you have open standards from which companies in various countries can develop products that are interoperable, you have the free flow of trade. If you have a lot of restrictions on intellectual property, we see this actually happening in China right now, where they are developing some standards that have a lot of intellectual property rights attached to them, then that can be used as an alternative form of a trade barrier. So it's very, very closely tied to economics, also not just politics.
We're speaking with Laura DeNardis of Yale's Information Society Project, author of the book Protocol Politics, The Globalization of Internet Governance on KZSU-FM Stanford and Hearsay Culture. Laura, we have a few minutes before our break, and I do want to ask you one more general question before we get into these issues of open standards and the various formats that exist or the main ones that you focus on, and that is the word globalization of Internet governance. I think many people certainly are familiar with the general background of the internet as having started as a Defense Department project and so forth. But you mentioned globalization specifically, and so I'll ask you, where is that globalization occurring? What is the meaning of that limiting word to the word governance?
Right. So I'm talking about the globalization, literally the globalization of internet governance, not the globalization of the internet, which I think is a little better understood. So we started in a world in which most of the standard setting took place in the United States by people who were involved either in the ARPANET project or attached to certain companies, like at the time Sun Microsystems, BBN, and other companies. Now, since that time, standard setting has become a much more global phenomenon, and standard-setting organizations such as the Internet Engineering Task Force, the World Wide Web Consortium, the International Telecommunication Union, I could list dozens and dozens of organizations. They've gone through a certain process of globalization in that they have, some of them, tried to incorporate more international interests into their design decisions and as well as open up the processes of standard-setting. So watching that unfold has been incredibly interesting. It's also been very interesting to watch, and there are various approaches to this around the world, to watch national governments try to get involved in some of the internet governance functions that historically have been done in a more multi-stakeholder fashion. So watching that unfold has been very interesting and in some cases alarming, but that's what I mean by globalization.
We are chatting with Laura Denardis of the Yale Information Society Project on KZSU-FM Stanford. For those of you that listen to KZSU regularly, you know that KZSU is a nonprofit, non-commercial radio station at Stanford University that relies on donations from listeners like you to continue its diverse programming. You have a couple of ways that you can make a donation to KZSU. You can email our underwriting department at underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu. Again, underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu. Or you can go to our webpage at kzsu.stanford.edu and click on Donate to KZSU. Regardless of what you do, I do hope that you consider that you will consider making a donation and that you continue to listen to the station. Laura, In your previous discussion, you talked about open standards, and perhaps this gets to one of the major issues that you discuss in the book, which is ultimately, when you get to the politics of this, the ability of developing countries to use the Internet in ways that they see fit versus how it's been traditionally designed. How do open standards fit into that analysis, and what do we mean by open standards?
Sure. This is a very controversial area. And I do have my own thoughts about how we define open standards, but there are many other taxonomies to think about this. So I'll just give you my framework for what openness means in standards. And I think it's very mine is consistent with the historical traditions of how the Internet has been developed. And I'm very concerned about changes in that area. So I'll just run through how I define it. First of all, what is the rationale? Why do we even care about this issue of what is in open standard? Think about how there are dozens upon dozens upon dozens of technical standard-setting institutions. I mentioned a few of these earlier, like the IEEE, which it's actually an acronym soup. I won't define all of the acronyms, but there are many different standard-setting organizations, ECMA, OASIS, ISO, ITU, W3C, IETF, there are many, many of these. And each of these organizations adheres to different procedural norms. They have different levels of participatory openness and standards for who can be involved in the standard setting process. They have different decisions about openness in the actual standard. Is it published? Do you have to pay a fee to access it? They have different policies on membership, intellectual property rights, due process. It's really a complex area because every standard-setting organization is a little bit different. Mark Lemley actually has a very interesting article about this, looking at some of the different approaches in standard-setting organizations. Now, the overarching question is, if you look at how there are different procedures and rules and norms in these standard-setting organizations, and on the other hand, if one believes that the decisions that they make are actually decisions about public policy, they're economic decisions, they make decisions about our civil liberties online, about access to knowledge. If you believe that, then the overarching question is this: what actually gives these primarily private institutions the legitimacy to be making these types of decisions that have public interest implications and that have historically been done by traditional governments? So openness is very important. Transparency is very important. If you look at democratic theory and legitimation, especially in various explorations of expertise and how you can have openness and legitimacy in any kind of a governance structure that's based on expertise, openness is a very important value. So I actually consider myself an open standards advocate. I want to describe three, I usually lay out three reasons for why openness is incredibly important in standard setting. There's a technical rationale, first of all. There's an economic rationale, second, and there's a political rationale. The technical rationale, as I mentioned before, is simply interoperability. Having a standard that is openly published with minimal intellectual property restrictions is the historical tradition of the Internet. It promotes the global flow of information, it enables economic competition, and a lot of economists have argued it maximizes innovation. So that's the economic rationale leading into that. If we have this promotion of product competition and innovation, this has the effect of preventing anti-competitive practices, of preventing trade barriers, and of having a high pace of innovation. So this sustains the internet's tradition of innovation. I would ask the question to anyone, if the early development of the internet involved standards that couldn't be accessed without a fee, or if they involved standards that had all types of intellectual property restrictions upon them, would we have the internet that we have today? So this is the economic and innovation rationale for openness. The political rationale is really this issue of how you create the necessary legitimacy for this work of primarily private or public-private standard-setting bodies to establish, in essence, public policy. So if so I lay out a framework in my book for a definition of open standard, and it's this. An open standard is one that is open in its development, open in its use, and open in its implementation. So if I may, Dave, I'd like to give a definition in each of those areas.
Sure.
Okay. Look at the issue of development. How open does a standard setting process have to be? Now, if this work was always just a purely technical exercise, then the nature of the work of standard setting probably would be irrelevant. But if you believe that there are some implications, like public interest implications that come out in the design process, then having participatory openness is very important. It allows multi-stakeholder participation, but it also allows for some oversight, some public oversight of what is actually happening. The second area of openness is open in implementation. So a completely open process is one that that publishes the standard, preferably with no fee. And so basically the blueprint necessary to develop products should be publicly available. And I also advocate for royalty-free standards where possible. This is not always possible. So having a standard available at least on some sort of reasonable and non-discriminatory basis is very important for the openness and the implementation. And then finally, a standard is open if it's open in use. And that just means that there are multiple competing products based on a standard, which hopefully reduces costs to users and it provides some sort of user choice. So this is the framework of openness that I advocate for.
We're talking with Laura DeNardis of the Yale Information Society Project on KZSU FM Stanford. Laura, so with regard to those various means of openness, we have countries like China, the main one that comes to mind, but also India, that want to be involved in this governance issue, and that turns us towards the political angle here. So perhaps you could describe, in your view, China's interest in internet expansion, which may seem obvious given the population and the economy, but how do their interests perhaps become problematic or difficult to negotiate for the bulk of the world that is using the internet already under its current format?
Right. Well, this really leads nicely into a discussion of the IPv4 and IPv6 transition. But just to speak about this in a general way for a few minutes, think about the I'm going to generalize this into a discussion of developing countries and standards. And I actually have an article about this called Open Standards and Global Politics. A country like India is, or pick any country in Northern Africa, for example, they're in a situation where they often have manufacturing facilities that produce products based on a certain standard. But at the same time, some of these standards have a lot of intellectual property restrictions. So that if the manufacturer who ran this processing, this facility suddenly moved, then that same country couldn't produce the same products without paying a lot of royalties for developing those same products. So this is kind of an issue. Developing countries are actually they're more affected by lack of openness and standards than Western countries, because they're often later entrants into standards processes. An entrepreneur in a developing country may not have a large legal staff to navigate the intellectual property restrictions, and there are many other factors. If you want to get into the discussion of the IPv6 issue, which brings China into play a little bit more, we could certainly do that.
Mm-hmm. Yes, please.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, so this actually requires just a little bit of technical background. The question is, what is this transition from IPv4 to IPv6, and what is at stake? So by IPv4 and IPv6, I'm talking about the Internet Protocol, IP. So this is very confusing in the halls of Yale Law School sometimes, because we usually use the acronym IP to mean intellectual property, but here I actually mean Internet Protocol. So when I use it for the majority of our discussion, I'm going to be meaning Internet Protocol. So okay. There are actually two versions of the Internet Protocol. One that has been around for a very long time and is the prevailing standard, and that's IPv4, and one that is much newer, and that's IPv6. Why do I focus on the Internet Protocol rather than some other protocol? In my opinion, this is one of the most important protocols that we should be concerned with for several reasons. One is it has the characteristic of universality. It's a necessary precondition to being on the Internet. So if I use IP, I can be on the Internet, and if I don't, I'm really not on the Internet. Why is that? Because to send information over the Internet, we all use a binary number, which is just a sequence of zeros and ones identifying the recipient and also identifying our computing devices. Now, this number is either assigned temporarily for a session, or it could be assigned more permanently. So I'll just read the opening line of my book. It opens up with the sentence, "The Internet is approaching a critical point. The world is running out of Internet addresses." So this is not just some theoretical problem, and I'm not using hyperbole here. It's a real circumstance at the level of technical architecture that arises really out of the success and growth of the Internet. So as I mentioned, every device that exchanges information over the Internet has to have a unique number. This is not really that unlike how we have the postal service. We all have a unique address identifying our home's physical location. In the case of Internet addresses, this is not a physical address, but it is a virtual address. And it's assigned either permanently to a computing device or temporarily for an Internet session. Now, under the prevailing standard, which is called IP version 4, there are approximately 4.3 billion available addresses. So that sounds like a lot, but if you think about the population of the world and how many Internet devices we each use, it's really not very many. This standard IPv4 that gives us the address space of 4.3 billion available addresses, that actually originated in the early 1980s. And what it did is it specified a 32-bit number for each Internet address. So think about if we have a coin. Think about heads being a zero and tails being a one. If we just flip the coin once, we have two possible outcomes. If we flip it twice, we have four possible outcomes, and so forth. So powers of two, it's the same thing with a binary number. If we have a 32-bit number, which is just a series of 32 zeros and ones, then that gives us 2 to the 32nd power possible addresses, or 4.3 billion roughly. So listeners might also be familiar with Internet addresses in the way that we communicate them as humans. So the computer reads 32 zeros and ones, but we speak about them in something called dotted decimal format. So Dave, have you heard a number such as 20.235.0.54?
I have.
Right. So sometimes when you're connecting to the Internet, you see the actual Internet address. You could actually type that into a URL and get a real Internet address. So every domain name has an associated Internet address with it, and then some. So the current standard provides 2 to the 32nd power, or approximately 4.3 billion unique addresses. Now, if you think about when internet engineers defined the standard, it was long before home computers, never mind the World Wide Web, or eBay, or Facebook, or any of that. So it really, really demonstrated a lot of foresight and optimism about the possible growth of the internet. But in the 21st century, it's obvious that 4.3 billion is insufficient to meet current demand, never mind projected internet demand. So I want to give a couple of statistics that are cited by some of the internet engineers about this from the Internet Engineering Task Force.
Okay.
Here's one statistic. In 2008, there were roughly 1.5 billion users on the internet. So that's probably not an exact number, but it gives us an order of magnitude. At the same time, only 17% of the available 4.3 billion internet addresses were still available, with an assignment rate of approximately 160 million being assigned per year. So you can definitely see what the problem is there, right, Dave?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so we're running out of internet addresses.
Right.
And so enter a new standard to try to solve this problem. Way back in 1990, actually, the internet standards community identified this potential problem and the potential depletion of these 4.3 billion addresses. And again, think about this. Even in 1999, that was before the World Wide Web, just before it. It was before Google, eBay, YouTube, and all that. And they decided to come up with a new standard called IP version 6 to exponentially expand the internet address space. They decided to have a new protocol that would expand this binary address field from 32 to 128 bits. So that doesn't sound like very much, but if you recall that we're dealing in powers of two here,
right,
it's actually orders of magnitude much higher. So in an address field of 128 bits supplies 2 to the 128th power addresses. And we run out of vocabulary to talk about this at that level. It's actually the going term is, you know, it's beyond billion, it's beyond trillion. It's 340 undecillion, if I'm even pronouncing that right, unique addresses.
Which is almost the size of the American debt at this point.
Well, a lot of people say it's equal to the grains of sand on the earth. I have no idea how they know how many grains of sand are on the earth, but the easiest way...
It's a lot of them.
Think about it mathematically. It's really just a 1 followed by about 36 zeros is what undecillion means. So there are tons of addresses under this new standard. So what's the problem? This protocol has been developed. It's been available for more than a decade. But despite the availability of the specifications and despite its widespread availability in products and despite the looming depletion of the IPv4 address space, the upgrade has really barely begun. And in my opinion, this is one of the most interesting stories in the whole history of the internet, to think about how this solution is available, but it's not really taking off to any great extent. Now, if you go back, if you just do a quick Google search on IPv6, what would be a good thing to search? Adoption projections. If you go back in time, you'll see that the press, technical communities, and certainly vendors, and this whole community of people who are IPv6 advocates, they've forecasted an imminent conversion to IPv6 for more than a decade. And also, beginning in 2000, a lot of, and this ties in the globalization question very well, governments in Japan, China, India, and Korea, these are countries that have much fewer addresses than we have here in the United States because of the historical fact, really, that the internet was originally an American phenomenon and because of the way that the addresses were originally doled out. Now, these governments established national strategies to upgrade to IPv6. And even despite that, the adoption uptake has been very, very slow for a variety of reasons. So this really has been incredibly interesting to me. I mean, part of the reason that there is a delay in upgrading is because the entities that have sufficient addresses don't really have the incentive to upgrade. So that's part of it. And also because of a technical reality that a device that uses native IPv4, meaning only IPv4, cannot communicate with a device that uses only IPv6 without some kind of a transition mechanism, such as like network address translation or having dual protocol stacks, such as IPv4 and IPv6 on each computer, which kind of defeats what we're trying to achieve here. So this is incredibly interesting. It really hasn't been much of an issue in the United States. I mean, have you heard about these issues a lot, Dave?
I've heard about them because I read closely, but they have certainly not surfaced as significant logistical problems for internet operations here.
Absolutely. And in fact, it didn't really become an issue in the United States until right after September 11th in the context of concerns over cybersecurity and the war on terrorism, where the Department of Defense became much more interested in IPv6, citing a requirement for greater security but mainly demand for more addresses for whatever military combat applications were envisioned to become at that time. But as I mentioned, the upgrade really has barely begun in the grand scheme of things. And part of that is because we just can't flip a switch and centrally upgrade the internet. There are a lot of centralized functions of internet governance, but the adoption of protocols is definitely not one of them. These decisions are very decentralized, and they involve a lot of coordinated action of not only internet operators and service providers, but governments, corporations, and even end users. So the transition, assuming that it can happen, can only happen incrementally.
We're left with about 5 minutes, Lauren. You've covered a lot of ground here, and so we can think about the future here. And this is where I start asking the unfair questions, where I ask questions that take more time to answer, and then I have to limit you severely. But as you've outlined this problem and talked about the issues, one question that comes up is if the United States is not impacted significantly by these issues, where will the impetus come from to make these changes that you outline, but that are not happening?
Right. And part of what you're asking is, what do I think is going to happen here?
Exactly.
Right. I think that we'll see three things happen. It's very dangerous to make any prediction about the internet because some unintended consequence always occurs, but I do think we'll see three things happen in the mid to long term. Now, I like to quote Vinton Cerf on this because I think he puts it very well. The value of IPv6 can only be realized if the deployment effort is broadly based on a global scale. So really, without any kind of killer application that requires IPv6 or without some huge new economic incentive, it's really unlikely that the existing global base of internet users will upgrade to IPv6 en masse. I think what we'll see is countries like China that develop certain networks that are IPv6 only, and then they communicate with the IPv4 world with some kind of address translation. Now, that brings up other issues about the choke points that can be created there, about the balkanization of the internet, and many other issues. We actually saw an interesting example of this in the Beijing Olympics when China used a lot of IPv6 in their Olympic internal networks. I thought that was really interesting, and it worked very well. Now, so one thing we're going to see, in my opinion, is some heightened global inequity, because those in parts of the world without large stores of IPv4 addresses will eventually experience access shortages. And out of this, we are likely to possibly see an increase in black markets for IP addresses, or possibly the introduction of internet address exchange markets. So this is a possibility for forestalling some of the shortages. This in and of itself, a very, very interesting topic, which I won't get into here, but these addresses have never been bought and sold, so moving them into exchange markets would be very interesting and would probably have a lot of consequences. Second thing that we'll see, I think, is increases in internet governance conflicts, because the Anyone who's been following the whole ICANN controversies over the years is aware of the global tensions over control of critical internet resources that have existed for years. Many of these have been over domain names, but also internet addresses. And I think that this will become heightened as we have increased depletion of IPv4 address space. So this is something to watch, because one possibility here is that governments might try to become more involved in internet address management. And this may not be a good thing, because or even introducing a market solution, like introducing address exchange markets, that could have unintended consequences, such as possibly attracting stricter government regulation of standards and of the internet address space. So a lot of things can happen there, but we're definitely going to have more attention over internet governance and control of the address space. And then another thing that I anticipate will continue to happen, this is already happening, is an architectural restructuring of the internet. So we often hear about the end-to-end design principle, and it actually is a little bit bothersome when people are talking about this like as something that actually exists right now, because we have had an erosion of the internet end-to-end principle for many years because of the introduction of network address translation that is exactly addressing this point of converting from IPv4 to IPv6, as well as firewalls and security protocols and things that are in the middle of the network and really have disrupted this a long time ago. But I think we can see a further erosion of this already eroded end-to-end architectural principle when we have IPv6 networks that are kind of off by themselves and then connected to the rest of the internet through network address translation and protocol translation. So what will be the unintended consequence of this is the question. But as a final thought, Dave,
mm-hmm. Yep.
If the history of the internet is any indication, well, we could see the introduction of a radical new application, a totally new application that requires so many IP addresses that it will finally present the economic incentive for a global upgrade to IPv6. So that is always a possibility that could completely supersede the problem of address scarcity. Or if the history of the internet is any indication, we could also see the development of a completely new internet protocol that also solves this problem.
Laura DeNardis, author of the book Protocol Politics, The Globalization of Internet Governance, and the director of the Yale Information Society Project. Laura, thank you so much for joining us on the show today. I mean, this is a both technical and profoundly important issue, and I appreciate you taking the time here today to bring this issue to the attention of the listeners. For those people who want to learn more about you as well as Yale's ISP, where can they go?
Well, I'll give you a couple of websites. Well, my own personal website is just lauradenardis.org, but the Yale ISP site is, you could find it by Googling Yale Information Society Project, or you could go to our main website at isp.law.yale.edu.
Laura, thank you so much for joining us today on the show. It's been a great conversation, and I invite you back on the show in the near future as this issue continues to develop to see where we're headed. But thanks again for taking the time today.
Thank you very much, Dave. My pleasure.
I'm excited to mention the guests coming up for the remaining shows on this summer quarter. Among them will be Jeremy Malcolm of Consumers International, discussing the anti-counterfeiting trade agreement and the work that Consumer International does with respect to transparency issues. Paul Jones of UNC and iBiblio will be on. Professors Eduardo Penalver of Cornell Law and Sonia Katyal of Fordham Law will be on, discussing their book, Property Outlaws. Professor Rob Frieden of Penn State's College of Communications will be on, discussing his book, Winning the Silicon Sweepstakes. Evgeny Morozov of Foreign Policy will be on, discussing his new book, How Dictators Learn to Stop Worrying and Love the Web. Associate Dean Michael Madison of the University of Pittsburgh School of Law will be on, discussing his work on the commons. And rounding out the summer quarter will be Professor Oded Shankar of Ohio State University's Fisher College of Business, author of the book Copycats. As always, there are a number of ways that you can listen to Hearsay Culture. The best way is to listen live on KZSU FM Stanford from 5 to 6 p.m. Pacific time on Wednesdays. You can also pick up the show by podcast by going to our iTunes page, that is Stanford Center for Internet Society's iTunes page, where you can pick up this show as well as other events occurring at Stanford CIS. You can also pick up the show by going to CIS's webpage at cyberlaw.stanford.edu. And lastly, you can get the show by going to hearsayculture.com, where you can get all previous shows, as well as look at the schedule and other information about the show. I always welcome your comments, suggestions, and feedback, and look for them. You can email me at dave@hearsayculture.com. Thanks again for listening to the show today. I hope you found it enjoyable and entertaining. Please stay tuned to KZSU for more diverse programming, and I will talk to you next week.